Today on The Bootstrap Founder, I'm talking to Jessica Melnick. We talk about communication, how to talk to your customers, how to do marketing, how to hire marketers, everything in the context of speaking, sharing your message with the people that you actually care about. We go into great detail into how to hire the right people for marketing and what remote work has to do with all of this. This conversation is sponsored by Acquire.com. More on that later. Now here's Jessica. Jessica, you publish a newsletter called The Remote Work Tribe, and you have a podcast with this project, and you teach people and businesses to succeed in a distributed world. I find that super interesting. Working from home myself, I think I've been remote for the last 5-6 years. So it's normal for me, but don't think it's normal for everybody. And I want to know, what's the mood out there now that this whole return to office stuff is becoming more popular? Do businesses still go remote, or is there change happening there?
Yeah, I love that question. And if I were to be totally honest, I started this site, and it was just a site, and then it turned into a podcast and a newsletter, basically because I was frustrated that this didn't exist when I first started as a remote worker. So I've been remote since the middle of 2015, so almost 10 years. Love it. Originally as an employee, and now as an entrepreneur, I've seen all the ebbs and flows. I became a manager for the second time when I was working remotely as an employee. And I was looking up to, at the time, this was like 2016. And I was like looking up to companies like Buffer and Zapier and other couple of companies that are just like OG remote. And I'm like, these are great, but they're very, very company specific. Why is there no like independent resource where I can collectively get the stories of a whole bunch of people? Sat on the sideline for a while. I'm like, okay, I'm an employee. I don't really have time for this. Then I went off on my own in the very end of 2018. Still didn't do this until, and then I eventually figured out, okay, like this still doesn't exist. 2019 rolls around. Towards the end of 2019, I launched the site. Originally just as a blog. Lo and behold, wound up with very good timing because about 3 months after I launched the site, a pandemic happened and suddenly a whole lot more people went remote all that time. So I kind of feel like to go back to your question today, I almost feel like a lot, like we're kind of going back to what remote work was before the pandemic. More companies have embraced that. So yes, there's definitely more companies that are utilizing, you know, a tighter labor market right now to go back to an office and almost quote unquote forcing layoffs. But I do think the really smart companies, particularly companies that are smaller and maybe want to have a competitive edge, are staying remote. And they're going back and learning the principles of the companies like the OGs, like the Buffers, the GitHubs, the Zapiers, and starting to realize, okay, this is actually what remote work is. And what remote work was in 2020 worked, but it was very different than what works long term.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the difference? Because that is, I find that first off, you're a prophet, right? Like you start this thing like a couple months before the world changes. I was thinking about that. Yeah, you got it, the timing just right. But you're keeping an eye on it now. And I want to know what the difference is there in remote work, what really crystallized over the last three and a half, four-ish years. What that change is that empowers companies now much better than it used to before that.
Yeah, I wish I could say I like knew that starting the remote work tribe when I did was going to be the best idea ever. Had no idea. And if anything, I actually probably blew a lot of 2020 because I was still thinking it was more of going to be like an affiliate site. And when it really started to take off was when I actually introduced a newsletter and a podcast. But I won't go into that. What I would say in terms of going back to your original question, which was about remote work and how it makes it work today versus how it was in 2020. In 2020, there was a lot of brands that were particularly larger companies that didn't really know how to work remote. So they just tried to adopt everything that was working in the office everyone was at home. And I'm like, A, that just doesn't work. Like, have you ever tried to be on Zoom meetings for 8 hours a day? Like, it is awful. Like, when you work remotely, it requires a different, it requires having people who can do that, because I'm the first one to admit, not everybody should be working from home. Not everyone should be working remotely, even if it's from a co-working space. And two, it requires a shift more towards what I call async communication. So yes, you need meetings, But if you're going to just try to adapt what you would do in office remotely, it just doesn't work as well as when it comes to actually requiring people who are really good, not only at being able to do meetings, but also really good at like being able to communicate asynchronously through Slack, through a project management software, through email, and making sure people are all rallied together. And you also have to have people who are, you know, able to self-motivate. So like if you need somebody over your shoulder, so I feel like the people who really struggled from the people who I know who really struggled in 2020 were often the folks who weren't as good, like, you know, aren't necessarily as good at being able to be self-directed or being able to be self-motivated.
Yeah, that, I think that is a big difference too. And I think it's just an understanding of management that motivation can come from the self. I think that's a new thing, right? That people can actually be self-directed and self-motivated, and they draw energy from their surroundings at home and not necessarily from constantly being surrounded by people in the office, right? Like it doesn't have to be people that provide that energy. It can be a location. It can be a situation. I think that's what I've found for myself, and you probably too, having done this for 10 years. Like we make our little nest from which we operate, right? This is our space, and the space gives us the energy to do what we do well, not the cubicle and the fact that there's a 10,000 cubicles around us, right? But it also offers us something new. And I think you are doing this. You are a fractional head of marketing. And I think that fractionality works really well with the asynchronous nature of work, right? All of a sudden, now you can batch work and you can do multiple things at the same time. I want to talk about this because I find this exciting. For as a person who for the longest time did not understand that hiring somebody doesn't mean that they have to work for you 40 hours a week. Like I, for some reason, I had trouble with this. But now I see this and there's a new wave of development, like fractional positions. Can you explain to me what you do as a fractional head of marketing and how that can work for startups or founders who are just getting started with their businesses, how they can integrate that without having to hire like a big head of marketing themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say in general, I mean, if you're trying to hire a head of marketing or, you know, a head of product or, you know, head of sales, head of customer success or whatever, those are really, all of them are really, really important roles. But it all comes down to, I mean, unless you are literally rolling in VC funds, which I don't suspect that many people are who are listening to this. And if you are, awesome.
Congrats.
Ignore all of my advice. However, if you're not rolling in VC funds, you do need to like stage out, okay, when does it make sense to hire all these positions? And one thing that I'm going to actually say is a little bit counterintuitive is don't try to outsource marketing until you have product market fit. Even if it's just in a really tiny vertical, I feel like I see a lot of companies stumble over themselves and or put a marketer in an unfair position. If you are brand new and you don't necessarily know your message, you don't really know who your ideal customers are, you have tons of churn, you haven't really quite figured out any of that yet, and you don't have product market fit, I am the biggest believer that as a founder or as like, you know, a co-founder, that's something that, lean on people like myself to give you advice, but ultimately it's really up to the founder at that point to figure out how to get product market fit. It could be in the tiniest vertical ever. Like you could be, whatchamacallit, what I'm going to give a random example, you know, having a software to help underwater basket weavers. And you figured out that you have this really tiny niche and there might only be 20 people, but you've gotten 7 of them. Cool. You have product market fit at that point. By all means, go find a marketer, go find a salesperson fractionally or in person and make that happen. However, if you don't have any of that yet, it becomes much harder to try to do that. It becomes much harder to try to hire someone. And then I'm always a big fan of just hire someone first, not full-time, to kind of help you figure out what you actually need. And then as you start to scale, then start bringing in those full-time people.
That's interesting. So it's and in the beginning, it's super fractional. It's like the tiniest fraction, and it just grows into a position. Is that something that you personally want for yourself, like being a fractional head of marketing? Do you want to ultimately end up as somebody who works full-time in a business, or do you want to stay diversified? Because that's, you know, something that a lot of indie hackers think about, like the small bets theory, a lot of small things and then see which ones work. What's the psychology for you there?
I love being self-employed. I call myself a solopreneur, but reality is I'm a solopreneur of a small team. I love the fact that I feel like I'm a little bit of a unicorn in the sense that I'm both a strategist who also still executes and still loves it. Like, my background's in copywriting. I still do a ton of copywriting all the time. And I love it. So I'm like, and I love the fact that I can like work across many different projects in a given time, and it kind of suits my personality. Much more there so than having to be constrained to working with just one company 40 or 50 hours a week.
Yeah, exactly. Would you consider yourself a generalist?
Yes and no. I feel like I've become a little bit more of a generalist since I've been out on my own for about 5 years now. But like, my real background is all in marketing and specifically in copywriting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, like the whole thing between like specialist T-shaped and M-shaped and pie-shaped, like there's all comb-shaped, right? Where you have a lot of different things. I think it's a continuum for sure. But the interesting part is that you had to be more of a generalist in building your own business. I think that's an important thing to notice here. Cool. I love the fact that you come from a writing background, because to me, what I've realized over the last couple of years is that writing is really just calcified thinking, or thinking in a different medium. So obviously you would be a writer and a strategist, because that kind of goes hand in hand. I love that. That's really cool. So how do you apply this when you have a role like a head of marketing? That sounds very cerebral. That sounds very strategic. How do you fit the actual work of writing, of making like choices on the word level? How do you fit this in your work?
I love that. And just to go back to something you said there, like, I could not agree more. Great writing is actually just great thinking. I can go off on a tangent about AI, about I guess I'll do that instead, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
My opinion about AI just in general is, like, out of all of the amazing use cases for artificial intelligence, I feel like a lot of companies chose the absolute worst, objectively worst one to start, where it's like, oh, let's automate writing. And I'm like, yeah, this doesn't work. Like, AI, in my opinion, is objectively terrible at writing, but it's absolutely amazing at a whole bunch of tasks related to it, particularly in the marketing side of things. And I can go off onto a tangent all about all of that.
Yeah,
but I also feel like when it comes to writing, it's all about thinking. So like, the reason why AI, at least in my experience, is it never produces really good content is because, like, you haven't done the hard work to actually think through what you want to say. And the writing becomes easy once you do that.
I love that. Oh, man, that is such a quotable thing. That is awesome. And I agree with you. Like, in my process, when I write my solo podcast episodes and all that, I do a lot of AI work in the preparation of it and in the quality control of it, but never in the actual creative part, right? I talk to a thing and it summarizes what I said. And then from that, I write and then I check. Right. But the writing itself is always in my mind, because I am the only arbiter of my thoughts. The AI can never guess what I'm thinking, right? There's no telepathy in there just yet. I mean, once we have the chip, right? The Neuralink chip in our mind, that's probably going to be different. But until then, that's cool. Do you still use AI? And how do you use AI in your writing or in your whole process?
Absolutely. I still use it all the time, similar to you. Like, even for a podcast like this, like, if I want to take some of this and turn this into a blog post later on, like, oftentimes I will take the transcript that I've did for an interview. I'll put that into a tool to be able to kind of get it to summarize it for me and be like, okay, start to tell me. And I'll start to ask it a bunch of questions. So I may be like, what did I cover, you know, at the very beginning? What are some of the most interesting quotes that you can pull out, just to see what the AI says? And sometimes it gets a little weird because AI will try to like hallucinate and say things I didn't actually say. Not all this is the case, but it's still really interesting. And then be like, what are the things that, you know, and they're asking me like, and being like, what are the gaps? Like, what did I miss here that I can maybe add on in a supplemental piece? And I'll kind of do that at the beginning. And then oftentimes I'll take all those questions and I'll be like, you have all this information, write me an outline. And I'll just be like, here's my outline. And then I'll start to be like, okay, this looks, usually about 70 to 80% of what I would actually include in there. And then from there, I'll do the writing myself. And then I'll feed it back into AI at the end and be like, help me figure out where are the gaps in this piece of, in this article. Help me figure out, you know, how do I make this almost like that first step? Like, I still think like I work with editors all the time, but oftentimes AI is like my first level editor right now, where it's like, help me figure out the gaps. Help me find the logic things that are missing and then be like, make this better. And then I'll send it over to an actual editor who's like a human and be like, help me make this even better. And it just makes my work, and it feels like it makes my writing clearer that way. And then oftentimes when it comes to SEO side of things as well, I'll often use it at the beginning as an outline to be like, to tell me what is the things that like is the most common advice on this topic. So I know what I have to include, but it also tells me it's like, okay, this is the most common stuff. This is going to be quote unquote copycat content. What are some additional things that I can add that are quote unquote originality nuggets so that this piece actually not only ranks well for Google if it's an SEO piece, but also are things that are going to actually convert better and build trust, because I'm not just regurgitating the same 20 things that Google already knows about that topic.
That's awesome. I love this. This is really, really human. Let me just say that, right? Like there's something to this approach that never loses the actual relationship between you and the reader. Like you may use whatever tools. It's like writing in pen or writing like with a quill, right? That's still a tool. Like the thoughts come from your mind and they make it onto the paper. AI is just a more established and maybe more powerful pen, but it is just that, right? It's just a tool to transmit thoughts from one medium to the other. I think if people would understand this, the internet would be a less trashy place. That would be great, right? Like I've seen so many programmatic SEO people that just churn out automated content to be able to rank, and then they rank and the volume of this just drowns out voices of people that actually have something to say. Like, what do you think about programmatic SEO? Like things that are completely automatically generated. I have a feeling where this might go, but I want to hear it from you.
I think programmatic SEO can work in very specific use cases. So if you have a SaaS that is horizontal in nature and you want to create landing pages to appeal to 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 different verticals where your SaaS applies, I think you can maybe create 10 of those pages or 20 of those pages yourself and then use programmatic SEO to do the rest. That makes a ton of sense, assuming you've kind of done the hard work of doing customer research, putting that into like, what are your value props and making sure your value props align to those main verticals that you really are going after. And then using programmatic SEO to fill in all the rest with your research makes a ton of sense. Where it makes a lot less sense and where I call, what I'm trying to call it, the McDonald's of content marketing, is when you try to use AI to suddenly, you know, be like, hey, there's a famous example of this about 3 months ago where someone's like, I'm just going to go on Ahrefs or I'm going to go on SEMrush and I'm going to go find my competitor. And I think it might have been like an Excel site. I forget what the name of it is. It's probably not even worth mentioning it. But somebody went in there and like, I'm just going to copy every single one of these pages and I'm going to write it all with AI. And they started to brag about how much traffic they were getting. Lo and behold, as you would expect, Google figured that out. And suddenly their site went from, you know, a 10x traffic increase to now five times less than before they started all the AI stuff. So I think in certain use cases, programmatic SEO makes sense. But if you're just trying to create hundreds or thousands of articles each month, all mostly through AI and little to no editing, you're in for a bad time.
Yeah, I really appreciate this. There's still a creative spark. There's still a human that does the work, and AI might amplify it, right? Like that's what you said with the verticals. You still have to write 10 of these. You still have to understand 10 different parts of your audience, and the AI then infers from your understanding what else to do. That still makes you do the work. And I want that to happen. I want people to still be able to do the work. That is great. That immediately makes sense to me. And trying to trick Google or trying to trick people for that matter is not good business, right? It's not a long-term perspective. It's not a strategy. It's a tactic, right? If at all. So I want to talk about that, like strategy in general, but thank you for sharing this this distinction. I think that just made clear to me that programmatic SEO is not evil. It's just, you know, badly applied in many ways. I think that distinction to any founder should be an interesting distinction to make, because if it's useful, use it. But if it's cheating, don't. It'll come back to bite you. Strategy. I want to dive into this, because you earlier said something very interesting when you were talking about the fractional nature of the head of marketing role, and how this should only ever really be considered after you found product market fit. And I can imagine there are a lot of good frameworks to strategize after that point. But most people listening to this probably are not yet at that point. So I would like to look into finding a good marketing strategy for people who are still pivoting around trying to find, you know, the elusive product market fit or product founder fit or founder market fit, whatever you may want to call it, right? The thing where you're not sure what you're doing, or if the thing you're doing is right, that you have signals, some from the market, but maybe not enough to say we're fully there, right? It's not 7 out of 20 underwater basket weavers just yet. So what would be a good approach? Like, do you have a couple of ideas that can help people find a strategy that is not just tactics along that path?
This is almost too probably simplistic, but I would just say in general, talk to your customers and get on a lot of sales calls. I feel like one of the biggest hurdles to kind of get over, and where you will learn more about this and be able to build out a strategy, is don't try to outsource your support or your sales too early. And I could probably make the case, as someone who is way more comfortable marketing than I am selling, and I get it. Like, I mean, hey, like, you know, if you're technical or you're a marketer or anything other than a natural salesperson, your natural tendency is to be like, okay, I want to outsource sales. And hey, I maybe even want to outsource customer support. But if you're building something from the ground up, like, that time you are talking to customers and hearing their use cases, hearing their pain points, hearing their goals, that all should inform your marketing strategy down the line, and you'll speed up that process so much faster if you're talking to even just 5 prospects or 5 customers a week. Amplify that over a month, that's 20 people. Like, at that point in time, like, you're going to get some insights. And then, yeah, there are frameworks you can use if you've never done an interview before. Like, my background and what I went to school for was journalism. Very quickly realized outside, like, you know, a year into it, that I'm like, I'm not sure I want to be in a newsroom. So I kind of fell into marketing, realized I was somewhat good at it, and stuck with it. So I have a little bit of a background when it comes to like knowing how to interview. But if you don't, there's so many great frameworks for it. So like following something like the Jobs to be Done framework is freaking amazing. And like a really, really practical version of that is I'm blanking in the name, but the book from Michelle Hansen.
Mm-hmm. Deploy Empathy, right?
Deploy Empathy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really, really practical version where it's like, if you've never ever talked to or interviewed a customer or interviewed a prospect before, following a framework like that is really, really helpful. Do that 20 times. I can guarantee you'll learn enough from that to be able to build out the building blocks of a marketing strategy. And then just start experimenting. The truth about marketing is it really is, when you're brand new or building out a brand new product, a lot of it is just thinking about it in terms of experiments. Another area where you can go wrong, besides just not talking to customers, is trying to run experiments too fast and trying to do too many fast. If you're just a founder, trying to be on 10 different marketing channels at once is a recipe for, best case scenario, just burning out. Worst case scenario, running out of money or just having nothing work. You want to like run an experiment and you want to make sure it's running for at least 3 months. If you have no signal after 3 months, then burn it to the ground, unless you just have no idea what you're doing. But if, yeah, you're trying to run 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 experiments at once, you're not going to do any of them as well. But like, yeah, just like take a hunch based off of when you're talking to customers, figuring out, okay, where are they hanging out? What, you know, how do they hear about solutions like yours? Start there. Learn that platform well enough to just be able to start running an experiment. Once you have it kind of going on, once you have good signals that it's starting to work, then start to outsource it to either, you know, someone in-house, like an in-house employee, a freelancer, a fractional person like myself, an agency. Yeah, But you really want to make sure that, like, you know, you're running those bets, but you're giving them enough time to actually work. Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I'm always thinking about if you want to outsource anything, you have to know what it is. You have to actually know what you're going to be outsourcing, right? If you can just say, make me money, right? That's not going to happen, right? So yeah, this is great. I think Deploy Empathy is one of the few books where I actually have a signed copy at home. So it's a book that I really, really value and have read as well and actually used in my most recent efforts for PodScan as well. Like I've been really, really into customer conversations. I just recently had one with a customer that just booked a call with me from a link that I sent out in my regular transactional emails that I have. So just, you know, like the things that tell you, hey, you're on the last day of your trial or whatever, or you have this kind of thing happening. And they booked a call with me, had the most wonderful conversation with my ideal customer persona about their issues, what they were trying to accomplish, you know, the jobs to be done thing, and where this fits into the larger workflow that they're in. That was incredibly helpful. Like I went away from this with a full page scribbled notes, and I could immediately pivot certain functions of my product towards that particular market much better. I could scrap a couple of things that I thought were important but were not, because all of a sudden I knew, okay, this is completely irrelevant to the actual job to be done. And I could add a few things that I thought they may or may not be relevant to the "this is highly important to these people" list. It was so useful because I could finally ask them, so what do you use this for? Like, what does your boss want you to deliver? And then they told me like four things that I never thought about, but obviously that is their job. So those conversations are worth their, you know, converted Zoom cost in gold. And it was really, really good. So thank you for bringing attention to this part of the process. I think that is one of the most high impact things you can do. And then take that and turn it into a strategy. I love that. That's a really good approach.
Absolutely. Like, I cannot stress enough, just like talking to your customers is the most important thing and the highest value activity, particularly early on. But even if you have some level of scale and product market fit, find ways to get in front of customers any way you possibly can, because you're going to learn a ton. At least I do every single time. And then the other thing I would actually mention that's probably a little bit less obvious, but I feel like I've learned the most from books about psychology and books about sales and books about negotiation. Because you can learn a lot of things about how to run an interview, how to kind of dive into what really motivates someone by those kinds of books, oftentimes more than quote unquote business books or marketing books.
Have you ever had trouble with this? Because I felt like in the calls that I'm in, I don't want to push people. Right? I don't want to push them into buying. I don't want to push them into giving up their secrets. Like, do you struggle with this too? And if so, do you overcome it? Like, other than just doing more and more of this, like, do you have any approach to finding value in, you know, giving a little bit of resistance or pushing a little bit?
Absolutely. I struggle with this all the time because I don't want to be like, you know, I want to have a conversation like this where it's a conversation and not an interrogation. But I also know that like sometimes like the best insights, and I always have to remind myself of this, often come when I'm like, when there's a little bit of an awkward silence and like when I start to embrace it, like when I do like, for example, a case study interview, and when I'm like interviewing, you know, somebody for a case study, like one of my clients' customers for a case study, oftentimes I'll get the best insights when I'm like, I ask my question, then I put myself on mute strategically, and I'll just kind of wait for 5 to 10 seconds.
Nice.
And you'll get really, really good answers doing that.
Ah, that's funny.
By just wanting to, like, at least for myself, embrace that awkward pause.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a great psychology little trick there, right? Where people cannot handle awkward silences and then they just actually give you the thing you want. That feels slightly manipulative, but I think in a good way, because it's information that is already, I mean, first off, it's already, if it's a question about their challenges, it's just real. It is their challenge, right? They might not want to admit that they have trouble, but they have it and you can help them, right? It just unearths a lot of necessary information. I love that. I think that's the kind of manipulation that I have to actively convince myself to be a good thing, because it is. It's kind of, you know, it feels like you're pulling strings that you shouldn't be. But I think a lot of introverts, like I would assume both of us, we are, you know, somewhat introverted in many different ways. A lot of indie hackers from a technical background certainly are. Like, we struggle with these interviews because we don't want to, you know, be confrontational. We don't want to talk to people that don't want to talk to us, that don't want to give up their secrets. But in the end, the fact that you can even land an interview with a customer means that they have something they want from you, right? And if you can pull it out from them what they need, then you can actually deliver it. That's kind of my self-talk that I have to allow myself to ask these questions and even ask them, so do you want to buy this? Right? That is such a hard question for me to ask because it's like, I don't want to hear the no. But the no is a good thing because if they say the no, then I understand what they actually need and they can tell me. So, you know, like that's one of the tricks that I use to convince myself. Do you have any more? Like, do you have any more kind of self-talk that helps you with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely relate to all of that as another introvert. Like, totally, totally get it. I would say two things that help. One that I probably should have even practiced at the beginning. Don't ask the hardest question up front. Give them a couple of questions that make them, like, that they're really comfortable with. So I always like to ask, be like, so tell me a little bit about, like, you know, what does your day-to-day look like? Or, you know, do something like A, oftentimes we'll learn something really interesting and that kind of informs follow-up questions. But B, it gets them really comfortable so that when I ask a question that might be a little bit more difficult or something that like feels a little, or maybe difficult is the wrong word, feels a little bit more awkward for me to ask, we already have that 10 minutes or 15 minutes of rapport. So it feels a little bit more natural. And then the second thing is I'm like the biggest fan and probably do this too much, of like being consultative, being like a consultant as opposed to a salesperson. So like, I want to be like, if I'm on a sales call or even if, and especially anything where it comes to like jobs to be done, I want to be the advisor or the consultant. I don't want to be the salesperson. So like, I often will like stray away from being like the question of like, do you want to buy this? And I'll phrase it in other ways where it's like, it still gives me the insights I want to hear, but I'm much more helping somebody get to that point themselves because you want them to feel like they're ready to buy instead of you being that pushy salesperson. And I know that was probably one of my biggest mistakes when I first went off into business on my own, where I'm like, I thought I had to be the pushy salesperson and surprise, surprise, didn't have much success on sales calls. But when I stopped and started to just embrace being the consultant, advisor, and helper, it became a lot easier.
That's a great reframe. I love this because that's also how I do that. I just want to help people, right? That's the general, my inclination is to be supportive and to give them the tools that they need to move themselves. So if I can do this the way I'm generally doing it anyway, because I'm also a consultant, right? I consult a lot of people. If those, the same methods, the same frameworks work, then I just embrace it for my own interviews. You know, you're already helping me a lot. I hope that people listening to this get something out of this as well, because this is really, really useful. I love this. That's really nice. Thank you for sharing all these insights. I think it's one of the scariest thing in business, particularly if you build a software business or anything in the virtual world, is to talk to real people. Like, I don't know what it is, but they're scary, right? It's not ones and zeros. It's complicated. And I think giving people the tools, the mental tools, and you mentioned burnout earlier too. So that's an interesting thing, like the mental health tools even to stay in business. That is a good thing. You talk about this on your website too. You have in the remote work tribe, you have like a little section that also talks about burnout. That also talks about mental health. Is that a topic that is important to you? Like in the whole context of, you know, both remote work, people being isolated at home, and people just solopreneuring their way through life, trying to figure out everything by themselves. Like, what moves you to talk about this topic?
Yeah, I think it's a topic that, especially before 2020. Wasn't talked about enough. And I even think today it is not talked about enough. And when I talk about it in the remote work tribe, I talk about it more from the level of making sure that your team isn't burning out. Because if one person burns out on the team, it trickles down. And even if nobody else burns out, like, it affects everybody else. So like, as a leader showing up, it's in your best interest to make sure nobody is completely burnt out, because that actually has a ripple effect across the entire team. And then also just like from my own experiences as an employee, having burned out about 7 years ago now. And again, like, I was able to kind of recover just with a little bit of therapy and like being a little bit more strategic about making sure I was taking vacations, because I loved what I was doing at the time, still loved what I was doing even after being burned out. But like, knowing that like there weren't great resources back then, I wanted to help more people. And I also just knew, just from pretty much anyone who is an entrepreneur for the most part, anyone who's a remote worker has at the very least had some thoughts of being like, am I burning out? Even if they don't even want to admit themselves. So like, being a little bit more open and talking about that side of things, particularly as a leader, if you have even just one other person on your team, like, that stuff's important.
Oh, man, it is probably one of the most important things you could do in a business is to make sure your people don't, like, hate their job or hate themselves for hating that job. There's so many layers to this. Like, to me, burning out has always been a very internal thing. Like, all mental health is internal, obviously, and something you kind of keep to yourself because you don't want to show weakness or whatever. So how do you make sure that you actually track this? Because it's often hidden, right? Like, mental health problems are often kind of suppressed and never make it to the surface. How do you make sure that your team is on the right track?
It's hard because it's people. Like, everything in, when it comes to anything to do with leadership and managing a team, it's all about, and like, there's a lot of people who are way more experienced at this than I. I've never managed a team of more than like a half dozen people. So like, I don't necessarily know, like, I'm not going to give advice for someone where it's like, if you are a department lead and you have a team of 10 or 20 people, my advice probably that I'm about to share is not going to be helpful. But I would just say in general, like, making sure that you're having one-to-ones on a regular basis and getting to know the person as a person and not just a cog in the machine. Because, and again, like, don't expect somebody, and particularly if you have a global team, like many of us do, like, it's going to be different based off of the individual, based on their culture, based on their background of how much they're going to be willing to share. But like, if you've worked with someone for a year or 2 years or 3 years, you're going to start to, and you really take the time to actually understand and get to know them and build a relationship with them as a person and not just a cog in the machine, you'll start to be able to intuitively figure out, it's like, oh, you seem a little off this week or whatever. And they'll probably start to bring it up by being a little more comfortable and then just encouraging people to like take breaks from work. Like, if you have a culture where suddenly everything's on fire and you require people to work 50 or 60 hours every single week for months on end, yeah, your team's probably going to burn out and they might not necessarily be comfortable telling you that. However, if you have a culture where like maybe you have worked really hard for a month, and you'd be like, hey, you did a great job during all this. Make sure, like, why don't you haven't taken a vacation in, you know, 6 weeks, in 6 months. Go take a week off. That's like being a good leader or whatever. And just kind of encouraging that. And also just being able to take hints from in those one-on-ones as you get to know somebody when things might be a little bit off.
I think the one-on-ones and building the relationship, that's at the core here, right? It's like you have to actually have a relationship with your employees. They're not just email addresses. They're not just like Slack names. They're people. And you have to really understand them. I think you're in a globally connected world as well, right? Now, you mentioned this very eloquently. Like, cultures deal with these things differently. I read this book a while ago called The Culture Map. That was extremely helpful in just understanding that some cultures talk about stress in a way that it is completely irritating to somebody from a different culture, or, you know, stress or success or needs or requirements or interpersonal challenges. Like, people talk about these things or even notice these things completely differently depending what culture and what part of the world they're from. I think the culture map should be required reading for everybody trying to build a global business. I definitely highly recommend that book because it opened up my eyes to like how I talk to people. And if you want to build a relationship with them, you should know what they expect from you, or what they expect a conversation about a topic that is kind of problematic to look like, even, right? So that's really cool. Do you have a globally distributed team at the moment right now? Like, is it quite global?
First of all, I really want to read The Culture Map. I've heard really good things. I have not actually read that book yet. And yes, like I said before, I'm a solopreneur for a really small team. But like, my team is spread out between Eastern Europe, and the US and Canada at the moment. But I've hired before and worked quite closely with people in the Philippines and in other parts of Southeast Asia. And like, this is where I'm going to give the example, which is in like, and I've done a lot of traveling in Asia, love places like Thailand and Vietnam. But like, in Asia in particular, it's like a really like high context culture.
Yes.
So like, and it's always for the most part, like, people default to the group instead of individualism, which is very different than America and in Canada. So it often means that you'll get some like, so like, I'm going to tell the story that I had where I had a VA in the Philippines for a while and they literally just disappeared one time. like just completely disappeared and apparently didn't realize at the time it's actually really common. And that's because they or like this person kind of internalized from within their own culture of not being very confrontational, of not being, of just being very, very, very conflict averse. So like, instead of saying like, I quit, they just disappear. Yeah. Again, that's an extreme example. And that was like about 3 years ago, but like it kind of opened my eyes to realize, okay, like there's actually nuances about the fact that like, oftentimes, particularly if you have somebody that you're working with in like the Philippines, I'm just going to give that example. Like you really need to pay attention any way you can to like the nonverbal cues and the body language, because it was in my experience that will tell you way, way, way more than what they're actually saying.
That is wonderful. And I love this because I literally, my situation is not, obviously I don't have this problem, but I have help from people in the Philippines as well. And communication, I'm trying to be very careful and very clear in how I communicate to be able to jump over this context barrier. Because I don't think you need to read the culture map. You just kind of mirrored back the most of the contents of this book, like the high context, low context, culture difference. That is one of the part, like the main parts of this book to explain this difference, which for some people doesn't even exist. But for somebody coming from Europe, like there's way less, for me at least, there's way less context here in Canada, but way more context in Southeast Asia. So it's nice to kind of know the gradients, the whole spectrum of this kind of communication.
Really also, cool. And as an American, there's even just like different nuances when it comes to where you are in the country, yeah, and like right. What your background is. So like, I grew up kind of in the South, and there's a lot of people that like how you communicate with somebody in Southern Georgia is going to be very, very different than how you're communicating with someone in New York City who's raised in New York City or in San Francisco. So like, there's just nuances even just from like locations within your same country.
Yeah, man, people are just way too complicated. Sometimes I just feel like, oh man, communication, this is always kind of hard, but it's absolutely worth it. And I think we went through several different ways of communicating with people today. Like we talked about writing, we talked about actually talking to them, and now we're talking about it and to our employees. I think we covered a lot of communication in this little chat we had here. I'm really, really happy that you invited me into your approach to all of these things. That is extremely helpful. I think I learned a lot today, and I bet people listening to this want to learn more. So if people want to find out more about you and the things that you do, the products that you have, the businesses that you run, where would you like them to go?
Absolutely. So like the easiest way to find me, if it's on social media, would just be to follow me on LinkedIn or on Twitter or on Threads. I believe I'm the same exact username in all of them, just Jessica Malnick on LinkedIn, on Twitter, or Twitter X. I'm still going to call it Twitter.
It's never going to be X.
and Threads. And then if you want to follow me a little bit closer, you can go to theremoteworktribe.com or newsletter.theremoteworktribe.com. And we release episodes and new newsletters about 1 to 2 times every single month.
Yeah, and you have this amazing podcast there as well. Let's talk about that too, right? Like that, if people want to learn more about remote work, people who work in this, people are experts in this field, they get to enjoy that podcast as well. I have it in my podcast list, just telling you, because I think it's cool. And as much as I'm trying to stay a solopreneur, I know that over time, my businesses will turn into remote businesses, right? Remote SaaS, B2B SaaS businesses. So obviously, I want to follow you and your knowledge in that field. So that's why you're in my podcast player. Thank you so much for sharing all of this today. That was extremely insightful. Thanks again for an amazing tour of how to communicate.
And thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. I will now briefly thank my sponsor, Acquire.com. Imagine this. You're a founder who's built a really solid SaaS product. You acquired all those customers and everything is generating really consistent monthly recurring revenue. That's the dream of every SaaS founder, right? Problem is, you're not growing for whatever reason. Maybe it's lack of skill or lack of focus or plain lack of interest. You don't know. You just feel stuck in your business with your business. What should you do? Well, the story that I would like to hear is that you buckled down, you reignited the fire, and you started working on the business, not just in the business. And all those things you did, like audience building and marketing and sales and outreach, they really helped you to go down this road, 6 months down the road, making all that money. You tripled your revenue and you have this hyper successful business. That is the dream. The reality, unfortunately, is not as simple as this. And the situation that you might find yourself in is looking different for every single founder who's facing this crossroad. This problem is common, but it looks different every time. But what doesn't look different every time is the story that here just ends up being one of inaction and stagnation, because the business becomes less and less valuable over time and then eventually completely worthless if you don't do anything. So if you find yourself here already at this point, or you think your story is likely headed down a similar road, I would consider a third option, and that is selling your business on Acquire.com. Because you capitalizing on the value of your time today is a pretty smart move. It's certainly better than not doing anything. And Acquire.com is free to list. They've helped hundreds of founders already. Just go check it out at try.acquire.com/Arvid, it's me, and see for yourself if this is the right option for you, your business at this time. You might just want to wait a bit and see if it works out half a year from now or a year from now. Just check it out. It's always good to be in the know. Thank you for listening to the Bootstrap Founder today. I really appreciate that. You can find me on Twitter at Arvid Kahl, A-R-V-I-D-K-A-H-L. And you find my books and my Twitter course there too. If you want to support me and this show, please subscribe to my YouTube channel. Get the podcast in your podcast player of choice, whatever that might be. Do let me know. It would be interesting to see. And leave a rating and a review by going to ratethispodcast.com/founder. It really makes a big difference if you show up there, because then this podcast shows up in other people's feeds. And that's, I think, where we all would like it to be, just helping other people learn and see and understand new things. Any of this will help the show. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye-bye.